This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. The recent Ice Bucket Challenge has dramatically increased research funding and awareness of ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig's disease. But it's difficult for the general population to truly understand how devastating the disease is to ALS patients as well as their families and friends. It strikes about 5,000 Americans each year. 90% of the people with ALS die within 3 to 5 years, and there is no known cure for the disease. Joining us to look at what we do know about ALS and what life is like for someone who has the disease are neurologist with the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute and director of the UC Health ALS Clinic, Dr. Robert Neal, and an ALS Association care coordinator and licensed social worker, Pinky Dressman. You can join the conversation at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. And before we start today, I do want to mention my mother died of ALS in 2008 in Northern Ohio, and I attended some of the support groups that Pinky led in the Cincinnati area while my mother was suffering with the disease. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon.
Glad to have you both here.
Thank you.
Dr. Neal, let's start with you. And I think a lot of people really have heard of ALS and Lou Gehrig's disease, especially now. But I'm not sure everyone has a really good concept and understanding of what it is. What is, and say what it is, because I can't pronounce it, the long name.
So it's amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. And so the disease is actually a degenerative nerve disease. If you think about your nervous system, you have a central nervous system, which is your brain and spinal cord, and you have a peripheral nervous system, which is the nerves that carry information out to your arms and legs to do stuff. Also carries information to your mouth, to your breathing, all that stuff. And basically what you have is deterioration of the nerves, both in the central compartment and the peripheral compartment, and they die off. So what that affects is voluntary muscle. So being able to move your arms, being able to move your legs, being able to swallow, chew, talk, breathe. Those kind of things. There's different types of muscle. There's also smooth muscle and cardiac muscle. It does not affect those systems. So if you think about cardiac muscle, your heart is a huge muscle. Why doesn't ALS affect that? It's selective to the motor neurons that affect the voluntary motor system, not the heart or the smooth muscle in your gut.
Well, you mentioned breathing. What about lungs? Are lungs, I guess lungs aren't a muscle.
They aren't really a muscle at all. The interesting thing about the breathing is the fact that you have your diaphragm and your chest wall that really help you breathe. And so those are voluntary muscles. The diaphragm is voluntary. You can stop yourself breathing at any time and hold it in. Just think of a yogi who can actually hold their breath for a long time. Same thing. So you have control over those motor neurons to do that. Your brain does that control. But you slowly lose control of that. You lose the ability to control that. Those become weaker and begin dying off.
Talking about how it all first is noticed or first becomes aware of it, what do people notice? It can affect different people in different ways. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes.
And so one of the things that we see most commonly is that people get, they pass around from doctor to doctor for a while. And they're trying to figure out, why did this happen? What's going on? Oftentimes we see them, they start with an orthopedic doctor. And it's because they're having weakness in an arm or weakness in a leg or a problem. And they're thinking, oh, I'm getting old. I have rotator cuff. That's what it is. And oftentimes they get passed around so much and no one really is sure exactly what they're dealing with yet until someone takes a little time and says, wait a minute. This is more than just a muscle problem. This is more than a bone problem. There's actually something breaking down here. And that's when we finally get to see them. And they say, you need to see a neurologist.
And that would be limb onset. But the bulbar onset, the person may sound like they've been out drinking. Or the first people say to them, have you been drinking? Or because their voice tends to slur. Or they find themselves clearing their throat after eating. Or they are having a little bit of shortness of breath, which is actually would be a respiratory onset, which is more rare than any of the other two. But bulbar affects a great deal of ALS patients too, besides limb onset.
And what's interesting about that, that what Pinky brings up the bulbar ALS, is those patients also have upper motor neuron. So imagine you have two different systems. You have the central compartment and the peripheral compartment. In the central compartment, when you have problems there, you get spasticity and problems like that.
What does that mean?
So spasticity is basically you lose the inhibition over the motor neurons that you normally would have. So a patient might sound like this and have trouble. So we always say the speed And the strangled quality of the voice is another way that a bulbar ALS patient can present. Not that breathy, kind of can't talk. Mm-hmm. So there are different ways that actually someone could present. I have not seen two patients that have presented exactly the same. And while they might present here, like Pinky was saying, in the mouth, or they might present in the lungs, mm-hmm. they might present in one arm, they might present in both arms, they might present in one leg, they might present in one side. So it can be very, very different. I think the thing that's the hallmark for us is really painless. It's a painless process. It's painless weakness. There shouldn't be sensory symptoms. There shouldn't be a lot of pain.
At least early on. Pain will enter into the equation later on.
And that's mainly just because you lose muscle. And one of the jobs of muscle is to keep joints off of each other. So if you think about it that way, pain is a later effect, but it's not the disease itself.
One of the things that you brought up, and certainly that I experienced with my own mom, is the idea that you don't know what's wrong for such a long time. And that can go on. I think in her case, it was a year mm-hmm. before we had any idea what was causing. I mean, she went through physical therapy and she was having trouble walking, and she went and her job was a receptionist. And they said, you talk so slowly on the phone now. Why are you talking so slowly on the phone? And nobody really knew. What do you advise people? Because it could happen, and somebody might need to see an orthopedic surgeon or orthopedic doctor and really have some other problems. How do you start to begin to ask the question, might this be ALS?
It's a good question. I think it's a matter of luck, actually. Do you get to a physician who has the ability to recognize those symptoms early on? Sometimes you don't get to that type of physician, and it's always a sad day for me when I get a referral of an ALS patient from hospice. We want to get them in the early diagnosis so we can get them all the help. But I think sometimes this disease mimics so many other illnesses that it's very hard for a doctor who has had very little experience with ALS to recognize the symptoms and get them onto the right person. It's more recognizing the early symptoms and knowing that it could possibly be ALS and more of a neurological disease than a bone or, you know, just simply muscle disease.
And I think what I would say is part of the failure is our system. We don't necessarily have a good education system for ALS. A lot of the advances of ALS, and classically in neurology, we're told, you know, you can diagnose everything you want, but you can't fix anything. And that has changed so much in the last 20 years for us, 30 years. Just look at stroke treatment. So for us, it's educating people again to recognize the signs early. And that means doctors educating doctors and future medical students, nursing staff, social workers, all sorts of people so that everyone knows about it. So again, you know, talking about it, educating, learning, that's what helps. I also would say that patients coming forward and telling their stories and letting people know.
Yes.
One of the things we see is that there can be mobility issues, so you can't get out of the house. And so people become shadows of who they used to be. And we lose the exposure that a lot of other people can have to say, look, this is what's happening to me, recognize it. And I think that's a...
I agree. Telling their story is very important. It's also very therapeutic for them to be able to tell their story.
One of the interesting parts of this to me was that there's really no test you can do to say, oh yeah, this is ALS. You test basically, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is just from my own experience with my mom, but you test for everything else. And I think the final thing they ruled out for her was multiple sclerosis. And when she didn't have that, then they said, you have ALS.
So I would say you look for everything else that this could be. MS is a very specific disease. So MS, again, oftentimes doesn't, it can be in the differential in the upper motor neuron, that central compartment form of ALS. But ALS is a combination of the two. And MS is a pure central nervous system or that central compartment disease. So you're looking for that combination of the two diseases. You're looking for signs on the exam. You're looking for signs and symptoms. And then you're also looking for electrophysiology. So any ALS patient will tell you one of the worst things is going through the EMG, which is a diagnostic test. It's not comfortable. But we do it all the time, and we have to do it. It's how we actually look at nerve and muscle.
Let's talk about what that is, because I will say they would not let me. They let me in the room with my mom for every test she took except that one. They said, you can't stay for this. It will be too uncomfortable for you to watch. And she was miserable when she came out from that one every time. She had to have it twice. So explain what you're trying to do when you do an EMG. What is that?
So an EMG is a test where I actually take a small needle. The needle is actually has two electrodes in it. Imagine it like you're doing an EKG. So you're looking at electrical waves from the heart. This, I'm looking at electrical waves of the muscle cells themselves. And I can read how the muscle cells are reacting to other muscle cells and to the nerves that are coming from your spinal cord. So that's why it's unfortunately a very direct test where you're putting needles in different muscles of someone's body. That's the painful part. If it's done well and you talk to your patient while you're doing the test, it's uncomfortable, but it will pass. And
what do you find out from it?
You can see signs of active nerve damage and chronic nerve damage, and you need both of those to be able to make the diagnosis. You can see nerve damage from, let's say, you pinched a nerve in your back a long time ago. I can see that. 5 years down the road, I can see that. But unless there's active, ongoing nerve damage, I won't see that. So I need to see both of those things, ongoing and chronic damage.
And I think that's part of the problem of the diagnosis, because we have some I get calls from patients that say, I'm a probable. They can't absolutely say I'm ALS at this time. And that can go on for a while, depending on their prognosis. It also impedes their ability to accept their diagnosis at times, because there isn't a definitive 100%. I mean, I think in working all these years with Dr. Neal, when he tells me it's ALS, I believe it's ALS. But that's when you're a person who actually gets that diagnosis and there's no 100% definitive, it kind of leaves you hanging until the symptoms catch up to a level that you know it can't be anything else. And unfortunately, that could be make you fairly advanced, middle to end stages sometimes.
We're talking today about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and we're going to continue our discussion in just a moment. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking this afternoon about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. My guest today, neurologist with the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute and director of the UC Health ALS Clinic, Dr. Robert Neal, and an ALS Association care coordinator, Pinky Dressman. She's also a licensed social worker. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. I do want you to know my mother died of ALS in 2008 in Northern Ohio, and I attended some of the support groups that Pinky led in the Cincinnati area while my mother was suffering from the disease. We've talked a lot about diagnosis and just what the disease is and explaining it. Once a person is diagnosed, what do you do?
Well, that's one of the things, because we can't cure the disease, we work on trying to make life better. And I would say that I've really worked on quality of life issues and trying to do a comprehensive care for a patient that involves looking at things like breathing, swallowing, talking, communication, mobility, the home environment, support networks. And we also have to, one of the things that doctors aren't good about necessarily is talking about mood and cognitive dysfunction. And there can be a lot of mood, a lot of depression, those kind of things. So I work with the tools that I have, which are usually medications and therapists and a team of professionals that actually help us help patients better.
And in my case, I, like I said earlier, I'd like to get them very early on because they might be still working. We have to help them get Social Security, get their Medicare benefits. If they're a veteran, we want to hook them up with the VA. We want to help, you know, get them involved with an elder med attorney to help get some of their affairs in order. And then we want to assess right away for equipment needs, depending on if they're struggling, if they need a manual wheelchair, or if they need a quad cane or a ramp for their house. Our association can provide these free of charge through our loaner program. And we have a monthly newsletter with lots of information. And when we get a patient that's diagnosed, immediately we send out a packet that is complete with 6 books on how to live with ALS, a complete resource guide, and lots of other helpful information, including the National ALS Directory, National Registry, that we want to get our patients registered so they can. It's the largest research project going on in the United States right now, and it's really critical that our patients are signing up for that. So we basically want to look at their whole life, how they're coping, and help them in every area that we can.
And on top of that, there is one medication that is FDA approved right now to slow down the disease process. It's called Ruyatec or Ruyazol. It's FDA approved. It can be very expensive if you don't have insurance. It can slow down the disease process by up to 2 months. We usually say maybe 2 to 3 months. So it's not like you're telling someone I'm going to stop this or I'm going to fix it, but I can slow this down. So patients get to make a decision about whether or not they want to take that medication.
And basically, they would just live for an additional 2 months if they take it, probably.
Correct. And one of the sad things about all the studies for that drug were that they actually just looked at quantity of life. They never really looked at quality of life. And that, I think, figures in so much into the discussion that you actually have to talk about that. And patients make their own decision based on that.
The number to call if you have a question is 513-419-7100. Gabrielle is calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Gabrielle. What's your question?
Hi. I was just curious. I have heard that ALS is pretty much concentrated in the developed world, incidence of the occurrence of it. And I'm just curious if either of you have an opinion as to why that's the case, why it's more common in the developed world.
I wonder if it's developed, if it's just the fact that maybe we're trained to recognize it and we see more of it, and that actually you have a lot of people in the underdeveloped world that actually are dying from this disease that don't know that that's what they're dying from. Even in our own country, we've seen an increase in the incidence and prevalence of this disease because we are being trained to recognize it better. And I think that's very common with a lot of diseases. Pink?
I think we see that, especially in our cases of 10% that are familial. And when they lost their great-grandparent to this, they didn't know it was ALS. It wasn't recognized, and now it is. So I think that has a lot to do with it.
Thanks so much for your call, Gabrielle. We appreciate it. Again, our number is 513-419-7100. Carol's calling from Delhi. Hi, Carol. What's your question?
Yes. My mother died in 1996, and she was down at UC. But she was diagnosed with primary lateral sclerosis. Mm-hmm. What is the difference between the two?
So primary lateral sclerosis is kind of a sister disease to ALS. Remember how we were talking a little bit before that there's the central compartment, which is your brain and spinal cord, and then there's the peripheral compartment, which is peripheral nerve and muscle. It's the one that actually affects the central system predominantly. And so you don't get the muscle wasting. You're dealing more with spasticity problems and all the problems of spasticity. I didn't explain spasticity better beforehand, but if you think about someone who has cerebral palsy or someone who's had a stroke, a lot of times you'll see the deficits of spasticity, which are tightness, inability to relax a lot of times. And it almost, again, when you hear them talk, it sounds like they are straining to speak. But it really is just, it's the upper motor neuron form. There's a lower motor neuron form called progressive or primary muscular atrophy. And that is the other one, the other side, where it's only in the peripheral compartment. The people with PLS, oftentimes I find it's a little
less aggressive.
It's a lot less aggressive, actually, and I've had a little. It's been a little bit easier to take care of them and to help them.
Yeah, and actually, we actually take care of both ALS and PLS because they're so closely related, and the symptoms are the same, and we can help them with our equipment the same way.
Carol, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Our number, 513-419-7100, if you have a question today about ALS. Ken is calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Ken.
Hello. How are you?
I'm good.
Just really wanted to call with a comment for the great work that Pinky does. My name is Ken Moore. I've done some ALS care here locally for some of the patients, and I think Pinky has actually secured me for a couple of those, and I'm just glad to hear that it's getting the exposure that it needs, just because the care is different in regard to the nature of the fact that the body is giving out around a very functional brain, which allows it to be a kind of a different care situation when you're dealing with the families and the situations. And just wanted to applaud Pinky for the excellent job she does. And
thank you, Ken.
Great work that Neil does, Dr. Neil does, in regard to this. I've had the ability to work with him and get the equipment and the things needed for the patients, and just wanted to say she does a great job.
Yes, she does.
Yeah.
Yes,
thanks.
She does.
Ken, thank you so much. We appreciate the call.
One of the things that I heard him talk about was actually the cognitive part. And one of the things that we've definitely recognized is that there is, in probably about 30% of the patients, there is cognitive. And it actually overlaps with a disease called frontotemporal dementia. And so this is one of the reasons also where I look for why a patient might have been missed for a while, is that they're not aware of what's happening to themselves. It's almost like a benevolent blissfulness that they don't know what's happening to them.
But it's very different from like an Alzheimer's type dementia, completely different. They can mask it beautifully. If you run into them in the middle of the street, you talk to them, never know they had this type of dementia. It's very different, and they have a hard time multitasking and following steps, and they might fixate on one idea, and they tend to not be as acceptive of measures that would be helpful for them, like the BiPAP or the feeding tube or things like that.
It's usually because they lose the ability to actually, for example, with the BiPAP, which is a respiratory aid, they forget that they need to keep it on, or they don't see why they keep having to put this back on at nighttime.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the BiPAP, and I'm a little bit familiar with it. My mom did use one of those. It's not a ventilator or anything like that. But what does it do to help the patient become more comfortable, especially when sleeping?
Well, the biggest thing is it gets rid of the CO2 that builds up in the patient's body, which is so dangerous and so critical that it gets removed because it's poisonous for them and makes them very fatigued. So it has a huge influence on their quality of life, and I'll let you talk about the specifics.
So basically your lungs function to exchange oxygen and to exchange carbon dioxide. You need to bring oxygen in, you need to get carbon dioxide out. Carbon dioxide is our waste product. It's bad. We use it. It's a common waste product for everything in our body. And basically what this does is the BiPAP pushes air in and keeps the airways open so that you can actually exchange oxygen and carbon dioxide. Our brains are kind of interesting in that they don't sense when carbon dioxide builds up very well. We have a good response when oxygen is low, and it says, hey, you need to do something about this. You start to feel short of breath. When carbon dioxide builds up, you just get sleepy, and you can get a headache. But it's not the same kind of panic that you get when oxygen goes low. But the BiPAP is basically a mask that goes over your face or over your nose. It can go just over your mouth, just over your nose. It can actually be just pillows under your nose, and it blows that air in so that you can effectively get rid of that poison.
And this is different than what the people use that have sleep apnea, correct?
It is different. It's a bilateral pressure, not a continuous pressure.
But you can have people, so there's CPAP, BiPAP, and then there's even now AVAP, and there are new functional types of these breathing devices. CPAP is what's recommended for people with just sleep apnea, and the bilevel PAP is, it's a little bit softer. It ramps up, actually, so it has two different pressures to it.
It pulls the air out, too, which pulls the CO2 out, which the continuous pressure does.
And that, of course, is just one of the pieces of equipment that people might need. We're going to talk about more of those in just a moment. But first, we're going to go to the phones. Again, our number, 513-419-7100, if you'd like to talk about ALS today. Eugene is calling from Mason. Hi, Eugene.
Hello.
What's your question?
I just wanted to know, what is the age range primarily when this occurs, ALS?
Unfortunately, it's probably, we would say, in the middle years, from 40 to 60. It has a predilection for males more than females, and probably white males more than African-American males in our country. But I will tell you, I've seen the age range from 20 to 94.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we've had patients that have been very elderly, dealing with this at the very end of their life.
It doesn't really discriminate between. Nope. I mean, there are more males, but then again, there's a strong relation between the military. And at that time, we had a lot more men in the military than women, so that might be a factor of that. Secondly, it doesn't affect socioeconomic. It can be any, it doesn't race. It doesn't discriminate. So it's a very non-discriminating disease.
Does that answer your question, Eugene?
Yes, I was wondering, is there any occupational studies that have been done to identify certain occupations where it may occur in, like, say, in radioactive material dealt with that?
Absolutely. Well, that's what our National Registry is all about. Right now, there's, I think, 12 to 14 surveys, and the newest surveys that are coming out on the National Registry are looking at environmental toxins, smoking, drinking, exposure to heavy metals. They look at locations of where you lived in case there's pockets, in case you were drinking cistern water versus city water, all those kind of things. So that's why we stress how important the National ALS Registry is. And you can do that through the Center of Disease Control.
Then there were some studies recently about not just veterans, but also professional soccer players that were looking at actually head trauma as one of the risk factors for ALS. Now, that doesn't hold for most of us, because we're not professional soccer players, and I'm not a veteran. But again, they were looking to find out, is it activity? Is it head trauma? There's overlap now that we know between the Parkinson's disease and also with some head trauma and veterans as well. So no one occupation is safe, but maybe there are a few that have a higher risk.
Eugene, thanks so much for your phone call. We appreciate it. Our number is 513-419-7100. Mary's calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Mary.
Hello, how are you?
Just fine, how are you?
Good. I just wanted to say that my husband was diagnosed in 2007, and we immediately joined the Cincinnati support group, and we're part of Pinky's group. And I just wanted to say that for people who might know of people who are diagnosed or who have been diagnosed themselves, getting to go to a support group is very important. It's important because not only do they support the patient, but they support the family so much, and you learn so much information. And the community of support in your support group, and our Central and Southern Ohio chapter includes Dayton, Columbus, and Cincinnati, and we just happen to be having ALS walks this month. But I just wanted to say Dr. Neal and Pinky work together so well, and it's important that people surround themselves with as much information as possible.
Mary, thanks so much for your call. I appreciate it. And as I talked about earlier in the program, my mom died from ALS, but she was diagnosed and lived in Northern Ohio, although my husband and I attended Pinky's support group here, and it really is helpful just to hear more about what's going on, because the disease is not that well known, and I think people are not aware of how severely it can affect people. We're going to get some more calls in just a moment, but I did want to ask, you talked about once a person is diagnosed with ALS, you go about trying to make them comfortable, to get the equipment they need to function. And you said, of course, there's no cure. There really, other than this one drug you mentioned, is not any other treatment. Is your role then as a doctor and as a social worker there to really just help make them comfortable for as long as they're here? Well, or is there something else?
I actually look at the use of the BiPAP and early use of the feeding tube as treatment. I also look at the interdisciplinary clinic as treatment. There have been some studies done in patients with ALS that go to the multidiscipline clinics tend to fare a lot better.
Let's talk about what those are. We haven't talked about the clinics. Tell us what they are.
So our clinic, we started in February of 2013, and basically it involves a medical doctor, a licensed social worker, a physical therapist, an occupational therapist, a speech therapist, a respiratory therapist. Mm-hmm. I think what we'd really like to have is a nutritionist also working with us, and also to have a psychologist.
Yes.
And that's something we'll continue to work on for the future. But a patient comes in, and they're in a room, and then every member of the team rotates around them. So it's very patient-centered care, where actually the doctor comes in, I do my part, Pinky comes in, she does her part. Then we move on. The physical therapist comes in. Everyone takes their role in helping them find what it is they need. And so it turns out to be a 2.5-3 hour visit for the patient, but it actually puts everything in one place. And I really do think that's better for the patient. It's also better for us, because we talk then. And we say, hey, Rob, did you know this is going on for that patient?
Right.
Or can you write these resting hand splints for me, because I need them for this patient?
Well, then we can very much coordinate care. So if they need equipment, then I see if I have it in my loan closet, and then I set up an appointment after clinic. If they need continued therapy for things, maybe evaluation for a power wheelchair, then they are scheduled through the therapist at, from the clinic. So I think we have a much better continuous of care and understanding of all that patient's complete needs in one setting.
You also mentioned that it's sort of patient-centered. You might point out too, and again, I speak from experience with my mom here, is that it's difficult to travel with the patient. It's very difficult to get them in and out of a car. And so rather than taking them from one appointment to another appointment, you just have to get them one place.
Correct.
And some people, if you have to take them in a wheelchair in a special van, maybe you don't own one of those. If you need to rent one or borrow it or get a ride just for that day, you're just going to one location.
Correct.
And Pinky, you mentioned the lending closet, I believe it was called.
We have a equipment loan program where we have donated. Families are so generous in this area. I have a huge equipment loan closet. And we have several hosts. Mulaney's gives us space free for our closet. And we work very closely with Care Medical, who gives us space for our power chairs, and Patient Aids, who takes our respiratory and our speech devices. So we are able to give out equipment, you know, whether it's a BiPAP or a power wheelchair or a ramp. And we do not have to charge for those services. We give it to them as long as they need it, and then they return it to us when they're no longer used. If they're using a walker and then they are no longer able to walk, the family returns it.
And I do want to remind people that we do have links to the website where you can get a hold of Pinky on our website at WVXU.org. Go to the Cincinnati Edition page. Dr. Neal?
I was also going to say one of the things that I heard you say was, again, just making the patient comfortable. And I'm not sure I agree with that statement, because I really think my job is to try and help people live the life they want to live. And they understand that, again, that they're dealing with an illness that has defined their life a little bit more than the rest of us. But Pinky and I have definitely had patients that have worked until the day they've died. Mm-hmm. And I will encourage that, and I'll never discourage it. People find different meaning in their life, whether it's their family or their career or their dreams, but they find ways to make those happen. And that's really where I think the art of medicine comes in, and that's what we try and do.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7. We're talking today about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. You can call us at 513-419-7100 or email us talk@wvxu.org. You also can find us on Facebook and Twitter. We'll continue our discussion in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Marianne Zalesnik. We're talking today about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Joining me are neurologist with the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute and director of the UC Health ALS Clinic, Dr. Robert Neal, and an ALS Association care coordinator and licensed social worker, Pinky Dressman. I also want to let you know my mother died of ALS in 2008 in Northern Ohio, and I attended some of the support groups that Pinky led in the Cincinnati area while my mother was suffering with the disease. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100, email us talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And lines are all filled up, so we're going to get to the phones quickly and see if we can answer some questions here. Jim's calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I'm now a marriage and family therapist in my old age, but I had three parishioners in my former profession who died of ALS. One was in Cincinnati, and I think he, as the husband, it was a doctor at UC, Dr. Peck. Did they start a research? Have you got research going on at UC as a result of the ALS cases you faced? And secondly, some of the frontline people that always get the issues first, whether it's ALS or whatever, as your social worker knows, are clergy. And I wonder how they could be involved in being, better pastors to their parishioners who have ALS. And I guess I conclude by saying keep up the good work. I hope you are doing research, or somebody is. Thanks.
Thank you. And we'll answer the question, I guess, while you're off the air. Go ahead.
So there is research, and there is actually a fund through the Greater Cincinnati Foundation that was set up by a family here in town, actually two families, where both of their loved ones had died from ALS. And it was designed to help with research. One of the issues is setting up a research establishment, and we're finally at that point now where we actually have a patient base and we actually have enough people in the clinic where we can establish research here. A lot of the research that's been going on in ALS has been a little disheartening. We don't know exactly what causes ALS. It would be one thing if we knew what caused it and then we could go after that target. We still don't really know that. And I liken that to the fact that we don't know what really even causes aging yet. We don't really know what is the one final point. If we had that answer, all of us would be happy. But we are actually involved in research. We have a research coordinator. We actually have trained up one of our medical assistants who is now actually able to do research with us and has been in our research division. And we have the funds from the Greater Cincinnati Foundation to start up a project. We're trying to get into the that NEALS, which is an ALS research group. And we're actually involved here in Cincinnati in something called the NeuroNext Project, which is set up by the National Institutes of Health. And it's actually a collaboration of 25 institutions out of Boston. So it's out of Harvard, really. And we're one of the 25 institutions that's involved in those research protocols.
Okay, and I'd like to say that we rely heavily on the clergy. We rely on the churches because, as we all know, community services are shrinking. And one of the greatest needs my patients have is for home care and having ramps built outside their home and maybe a handicap van. And the churches, you know, I constantly talk to my families about reaching out to their local community churches. There are so many wonderful health ministry organizations going in and on in some of the churches where they can actually provide some care through their health ministry, or they have volunteers that are willing to come out and put up a ramp for somebody who can't get in their home. So I really implore all our families to check with the churches in their local community. A lot of times you don't even have to be a member of that particular church to get their services. So that's a great idea.
513-419-7100 is our number if you have a question today about ALS. Mike is calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Mike. Mike, what's your question?
I've been dealing with this dreadful disease since the mid-70s. My grandpa passed away of it in 79 and my mother in 2000. And like I say, it's hard for me to talk, I'm sorry, but it's a dreadful disease, and if anybody's went through it, they would know how bad of a disease it is. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But the heredity issue, we talked to a doctor up in Cleveland Clinic, and he was astounded when we told him that her father died of the disease. He said it was very, very rare, and I've really found no other, you know, information on it about how, you know, the hereditary factor is, you know, for children or, you know, siblings.
Yeah, Dr. Neal, can you address that?
So we know probably about 10% of the cases of ALS are familial. And we probably can figure out about 60% of the genetic mutations that cause ALS. When I was going through my medical training, we thought it was one thing called superoxide dismutase 1, which was the most common type of mutation. Now we know that's not the most common mutation anymore. There's another one. You can get tested for genetics, but we still tell people that they've only figured out about 60% of the genetics, which really in our hubris, I think that's probably even an overstatement. So right now we know that 60% we've discovered. But there's no routine genetic testing. There's an expensive battery of tests you can do, and you can do it through Children's Hospital, actually. I have sent families to Children's Hospital to get genetic counseling and testing. But you don't want to just do genetic testing without talking to a counselor and understanding the true risks that go with it.
Mike, does that answer your question?
It sure does. Thank you so much, and thanks for all your good work.
Thank you for your call, Mike. We appreciate it. Wilson is calling from Westchester. Hi, Wilson. What's your question?
Hi. This is a follow-up to what Mike had. In my family, my sister died a year and a half ago in her 70s of ALS. My dad's oldest sister died in her 70s and during the 1980s of ALS. And my dad's aunt died of ALS in the 1930s. Three generations in our family, all female, but it has not been direct female lineage. But anyway, I have nieces and nephews that are really freaked out about this whole thing. And I know in a follow-up to what you were telling Mike about the familial genetics of this, because I know there is a small group, 10 or 20%, but the point is, how many families have been, or are there a number of families that are put into these kinds of studies to where you have a much better tracking of this sort of thing? And what is the genetic role of this?
Dr. Neal?
Again, if there was one reason why we aged and why cells die in our system, we'd have this disease already licked. The genetics actually, I really encourage people to, one, get in the registries. And if they have the financial means to be able to figure out the genetic mutation that they might have, I would encourage that as well. That aids us. I had a patient who passed recently who wanted desperately to give her blood and her genetic materials because she also found out that she was familial. And she didn't want a future generation to miss it. As far as trying to figure out, again, it's you have to see a genetic counselor. You probably would do better at doing it at Children's. I think the best advice I gave a family yesterday, I saw a patient with his three kids, and we talked about this, and I said the most important thing for the kids is to be aware of the signs and symptoms of ALS and what to watch out for, because right now the science is limited compared to what a clinician can actually do and what you can do. I apologize for that. I wish that was very different.
Wilson, thanks so much for your...
It is a very horrible disease. My aunt and my dad's aunt both died of skeletal muscle ALS. My sister died of involuntary muscle ALS.
Okay, well, we really are so sorry for your loss, and I can certainly relate. As I said, my mom died of ALS in 2008, and we thank you so much for your call, Wilson. We appreciate it. Our phone number is 513-419-7100. Bill's calling from Hamilton. Hi, Bill.
Hello, how are you?
I'm good. What's your question today?
Well, I wanted to offer a very small comment. That is, I did know a man several years ago who died from ALS, and probably 10 years before he was actually diagnosed, he would often complain about having vertigo. Didn't know if that was a very early symptom, but I thought I'd throw that in there. I guess my question might be the million-dollar question that you probably can't answer, and that is, what makes it so difficult to drill down into what is the cause of this terrible disease? Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, scientifically, again, so the cells that are dying off are motor neuron cells in your nervous system. And we know that these cells die off normally as we get older. You're born with the same nerves that you have for the rest of your life. And they start to die off probably in our 30s, a little bit more aggressively in our 40s, and then slowly over the rest of our life, they start dying off. We don't even understand that process and what signals that, what causes that to happen. I wish, again, we did. There are different mechanisms of why cells might die. Some of them have a DNA issue, and the DNA says, I'm done replicating. I can't do this anymore. For others, it's a transport issue. Again, if you think about the cells that are in your spinal cord, they actually go all the way down to your leg. That those cells actually have to get material from the cell body in your spinal cord all the way down to your leg. And that's a transport mechanism. So you can see there's no one definite reason. So we have all sorts of different targets to look for why these cells are dying, but not one. We have not found just one.
Our phone number, 513-419-7100. Carolyn's calling from Dayton. Hi, Carolyn.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'm interested in the relation, if any, between myasthenia gravis, which I happen to have, and ALS.
So myasthenia gravis is a pure disease of the peripheral compartment that we were talking about earlier. It's a disease where your immune system is actually revved up and actually attacks the connection between your nerve and your muscle. So it even starts out at the very beginning, has a different pathophysiology. It's one actually that I can turn your immune system down and quiet down the disease. Whereas in ALS, because we don't have an autoimmune component or a component of your immune system attacking, I don't have that same target to attack. So this is, for those suffering with myasthenia gravis, I mean no casualness, but I actually, when I find a patient with myasthenia gravis, I can smile to myself because I know I'm going to be able to usually fix that. And I can stop people from dying from that disease.
To medication. Sometimes when people ask me, I say it seems to be a distant cousin to ALS in the terms of the muscles become weak. But
yes.
We don't die ordinarily of myasthenia.
Correct. If we're doing our job as doctors, we actually can keep the mortality very low there and something
right.
else.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for sharing your story. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Robert is calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Robert. What's your question?
My father had ALS. He died about 26 years ago. Had it for about a year and a half. And my question is actually two-part. I'm curious as to why physicist Stephen Hawking has been able to live decades with this, and if there's anyone else who has lived as long as he has with this.
Well, I can say that Stephen Hawking has a lot of resources. I don't know if this is true. I think I read one time that he has a team of 7 physicians on hand at any given time and unlimited resources for care and that probably plays a big role in survival, but he's also opted for the invasive ventilation. And if they're able to keep infection and things like that under control, you can really prolong someone's life. So that intense medical care that he has isn't available to every average Joe.
Yeah, I would agree with Pinky on this one. I've had a few families who've chosen to use the ventilator, which means that, again, when your chest wall isn't able to breathe for you anymore, a machine does the breathing for you. That pretty much requires you creating an ICU in your home so that you have 24-hour nursing care. Things happen to ventilators. You can get a mucus plug in them. They can clog up. They can stop. The battery can run out, all sorts of things. And so, really, I've had a few families that done it successfully, and they did it by actually having family and paying private practice nursing to come in and take care of their loved ones.
I had also heard somewhere along the way that there's some people that doubt that what he has is actually ALS.
There is that speculation that we don't know exactly what he has. I can think of one patient that Pinky and I share in common who has probably PLS, which is the upper motor neuron version. And I believe he's been dealing with it for 17 or 19 years at this point.
Oh, yeah.
And so, again, there's a wide variety of this disease, and you can see a different spectrum. I've seen definitely people who have died within a year. I've seen people that have lasted 7 to 8 years. And then I've seen the rare, extraordinary individuals that go 10, 20 years.
Robert, thanks so much for your call. We appreciate it. Gary's calling from Cincinnati. Hi, Gary. What's your question?
Hi, my name is Gary. I'm a chaplain with Crossroads Hospice, and I've had an opportunity to work with Pinky and with a patient and a good friend of ours who died of ALS. And I was wondering if Pinky or Dr. Neal could comment on when hospice care is helpful to the patient and to the family.
Well, I would love to answer this question. I think it's one of these things where it's very important that you're having close communication with your neurologist, because ultimately it's the neurologist who will make the decision on when hospice is physically appropriate. But when you have a really good neurologist, they're also getting input from others. When you're not just looking strictly at physical care, you're looking at the help needed in the home. But basically, there's a set of guidelines that hospice has that we follow for ALS. The ability to breathe out drops to 35. They may have significant weight loss or be taking nourishment strictly by feeding tube, or can't ambulate, or things like that. So especially through the clinics as a team, we often look at and make a decision on hospice. But generally, if I'm talking to a patient and I think it's appropriate, I will highly recommend that they contact their neurologist and have that conversation. But if they're seeing their neurologist every 3 months, the neurologist will usually generally make that call.
And hospice is a 6-month benefit, according to Medicare. So we usually look at, again, I'm not God, I can't predict when people are going to pass, but trying to understand some basic pathophys and understanding when people are actually going to face the most problems. And in that last 6 months of life, getting them the help so that they can have quality of life during that last 6 months.
The patient also has to be ready for
yes.
it mentally,
yes.
and that's another component.
Thanks so much for your call, Gary. We appreciate it. My mom was in hospice at the end, but it took a while for us to be able to get her into the hospice program. And I think she was ready before hospice was ready for her, frankly. And in that instance, she felt like it was time. We are almost out of time. One thing we haven't gotten to, we've got about 30 seconds left, which is not nearly long enough, because we've talked so much about the patients, but not the caregivers. I'm sure you have some information on your websites about that. Just a quick advice to those dealing with the family members, the friends dealing with people that have ALS.
Contact your local chapter to get support and attend the support groups, because those are caregivers connecting with other caregivers and giving support. But we have a lot of support we can give caregivers and a lot of resources.
And please don't neglect those patients. What I would say is make sure you make social contact with them. Make sure you, again, it's easy to avoid people who are sick. To me, that's actually the worst crime that we can have in our community, is actually to avoid those patients.
Thank you both so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
And thank you for listening to Cincinnati Edition. We've been talking about ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. My guest, neurologist with the University of Cincinnati Neuroscience Institute and director of the UC Health ALS Clinic, Dr. Robert Neal, and ALS Association Care Coordinator Pinky Dressman. Cincinnati Edition is produced by Pete Reitmeier. Today's technical director was Rick Andres. We also had help today from Kevin Reynolds and Jim Nolan. Our engineering staff is Don Danko, Bill Dean, and Mike Makinich. Archives of our program are available on our website, wvxu.org. I'm Marianne Zalesnik.